church. I hope I can live up to that introduction. But I think that what my talk will do today will be to illustrate for those of you who are in the earlier stages how, in fact, I took a clinical issue that I was struggling with every day as I was seeing patients and then tried to disentangle the pieces and the problems to come up with a systematic way of trying to maybe do things different and better. So what I'm going to be talking about is promoting advanced care planning as a process of health behavior change. There's an awful lot of words in that. So what I'm going to start with is to describe some of the conceptual models underlying the research, then provide some evidence in support of these models, and then discuss strategies for what I'm proposing to do next to test an intervention that arises. So there are two major concepts organizing today's talk, all the words in the title. The first is advanced care planning, which I'll refer to for brevity's sake as ACP, and the second is health behavior change. And what we'll do is to examine each of these concepts as they pertain to the task of promoting people to engage in an important process of ACP. Okay, so what is advanced care planning? It's the process by which individuals can plan for a time of decisional incapacity for health care decisions. So it's planning ahead for when you're sick enough that you cannot participate in the process. It's traditionally been implemented with the completion of documents, living wills, health care process. And the goal of these documents, pretty much, is to have people pre-specify the care that they would want to receive. There's some problems, I think a pretty significant problem, with this form of doing ACP. First, let's deal with living wills, which lots of people have, but it's been proven in multiple studies that they're not always very helpful. Well, why is that? Because if you see the wording on most living wills, generally in terms of withholding treatment, only in the most extreme circumstances, known with certainty. How often do we find ourselves in that situation? Almost never, so that the language almost becomes ridiculous and that, you know, if it's clear to everybody that I'm dying, I want to be let to die. Well, okay, but that doesn't help with the myriad of decisions that come along the way when we're not sure if somebody's dying. Even if somebody isn't imminently dying, there may be burdens involved with treatment that they might not want to have. So not very helpful. Physicians therefore have difficulty applying this to specific clinical situations. So as a result of some of those limitations, people have come up with the idea, okay, let's not be so specific then, and have people write down their value statements. These are things where, or documents where people can indicate what, in general, what's most important to them. Things like, you know, I prefer to have my pain treated, even if that shortened my life. My dignity is very important to me. Although that's very important information to have, the problem is those are even harder to apply to specific clinical situations. And there's another more global problem with all of these kinds of documents that ask people to say in advance what they would want in the future. They ignore the process of adaptation, which is a very powerful process. It's what makes us human, that we have this wonderful ability to adapt to our current circumstances. So it's been shown a number of times now that individuals change their valuations of diminished health once they experience it. So for example, young healthy people will say things like, I never want to end up, and you can fill in the blank. Well, if we're unfortunate enough to end up in the fill in the blank, oftentimes it doesn't look so bad once we get there. The issue is, though, the ability to need to change on a dime as well, because it may become acceptable, but then once again the burdens of illness become so severe that acceptability changes back to unacceptability. None of these documents take any of those processes into account. So then the next idea was, well, then let's have a knowledgeable person, a healthcare proxy, a decision maker. That way we don't have to worry so much about the specific decisions. The hope would be that this person would be able to represent Well, the problem is that just by signing a form doesn't make a proxy an informed proxy. So proxies frequently don't know patients' wishes. Also, proxies use factors other than the patient's preference to make decisions because the proxy is the one who's often delivering the care. And so there are burdens and requirements on the proxy that the healthcare proxy document doesn't recognize really ought to be taken into account in the decision-making process. And we know because patients themselves say they want their proxies to have leeway in decisions because they recognize that the proxy needs to take his or own interests sometimes into account. And proxies struggle with being put in the role of making decisions for loved ones. So although I'm not saying that these forms of advanced care planning should be done away with, they have really, really important limitations that if you don't address, they can't be effective in terms of improving end-of-life care and decision-making. So we've argued that we need to change the focus of advanced care planning. So if you remember, I said the traditional focus is to have the patient make a decision ahead of time. Well, really, if you think about it, the best decisions are based on a careful consideration of clinical circumstances that involves clinician judgment, surrogate needs, and the best sense of what we know are potentially changing patient goals. And so that leads me to argue that the objective should be to prepare patients and families to participate in the moment decisions, get them ready to be able to do the best job possible in the moment, rather than trying to force premature decisions ahead of time. This model also recognizes the fact that we don't prepare patients terribly well to participate even before they lose decision-making capacity. And so this reminds us that it's a hard enough job to make these value-laden and decisions that are fraught with all sorts of emotional difficulties, that we need to prepare patients to be able to do this, not just the surrogate decision-maker. So with this new, different vision of advanced care planning, the process looks a little different. And we've identified three key steps that we think are necessary to accomplish this advanced care planning objective. So we still need for there to be an appropriate surrogate decision maker if the patient can't participate, because we know that lots of these decisions require surrogate decision making. The second step is to help for patients to articulate and clarify their values, but importantly, over time, so that we, as clinicians, the family members, can begin to see whether, in fact, patients are adapting, or whether, in fact, some circumstances or some experiences are so distasteful to patients that they really can begin to identify non-changeable points at which they say, okay, this is going to be enough. And then the third part is this notion of establishing leeway in surrogate decision making, so that if you can explicitly ahead of time identify those decisions where the patient's saying, yes, I want you to take into account your needs, then that can actually reduce a lot of the burden that the surrogate decision maker may feel at the time of making the decision. So what would these steps look like? Well, the first one, choosing an appropriate surrogate decision maker. If you were to become really sick, is there anyone you trust to make medical decisions for you? Does this person know that you have chosen him or her for the role? It's important to ask him or her if that person is willing to do it. And one thing that I left off the slide, but equally important, is, and then you need to sit down with the rest of your extended family. They know too, right? See that recent New England Journal article about the long lost
daughter in California.
Exactly. Right. Well, you can prevent that if everybody hears, and ignite. Different families will have different ways of how it happens. Everybody decides together, but the important thing is somebody has the final decision making capacity. Then this is the part that actually I could give you a whole other talk on, and how we clarify and articulate patients' values. Very, very difficult, especially for people who haven't yet experienced serious illness. So if you're starting with somebody like that, you know what? We'll go with any experience the person has. So have you seen someone on TV? Had somebody close to you had an experience? Now, with TV, we also know from the literature that we then have to correct all the misperceptions about people arising from coma and, you know, people surviving cardiopulmonary resuscitation. But nonetheless, it's a starting point. The thing is to make this as least hypothetical as possible. Work with people's actual experiences. Did this situation make you think of ways of being that would be so unacceptable that you would consider it worse than death? The point is here, we're trying to find people's stopping points. When is it going to be too much for them? You can give them examples. Some patients say that if they couldn't recognize or talk to their loved ones, that would be such a point. And so to give some examples, finding where people might say that, yes, this is where I'm going to tip my decision-making. But again, importantly, doing this over time, revisiting this after an episode of acute illness, after a new diagnosis, after progression of illness. And then finally, establishing surrogate leeway. Having told me what's important to you, what if your surrogate finds it difficult to provide this for you? So for example, the thing that we hear a lot from people is, I never want to go to a nursing home, and I'd like to die at home. Well, those things put tremendous, can put tremendous burden on the caregivers. And so if we can visit those things in advance, what if it's just too hard for your family member? Because relieving burden is also really important to a lot of people, what we're doing is identifying that there may be conflicting values and figuring out what's going to trump. What if the doctor recommends something else? You know, what if there reaches a point where the doctor's really saying there's not a plan that might satisfy what you want? So will you give your loved ones permission to work with your doctors to make the best decision they can for you, even if it's different from what you said you wanted? But then are there certain decisions that you would never want your loved one to, because better for the loved one to hear that, it might be negotiable, it might be not, but at least we get these things out in the open and talked about ahead of time. So that's the first concept, advanced care planning. What we know about this is that not a lot of people engage in any form of advanced care planning. The traditional forms, certainly not these newer ideas of communication. And so that's what leads us to the second concept organizing today's talk, which is health behavior change. So the traditional approach to getting people to do advanced care planning is on the if you build it, they will come model. We're sort of saying just give people forms, give them education, and they will engage in this. Sort of the notion that there's this big pent-up demand out there, that if only people knew, they'd be diving in and doing this. Well, that approach has only been minimally effective in increasing the rates of document completion. And a few early studies asked people who didn't respond to the intervention, why not? And procrastination was the big response. Well, what does that word procrastination really mean? Well, again, the assumption was that people want to do this. But if you spend a minute thinking about this in a sort of common sense kind of way, this may not be true for lots of people. First of all, especially if you've witnessed what happened with the Obama health plan and the politicalization of death panels, people may be concerned about getting too little rather than too much care. I haven't seen any good, this is a study, like a Nielsen study I would love to do. I haven't seen good data, but certainly I believe this is the case, and we see it less, because I have colleagues, you know, who are not in such blue states and say that this is what dominates. I have a fellow, actually, who says she went home over a break, and to hear her family talk about geriatrics, they see it as this huge conspiracy, basically, to knock off grandma. I mean, what we hear in the political realm it has a basis in how people are talking about this. Secondly, it's very difficult to think about these things. There aren't a lot of people, and there's certainly some, but there aren't a lot of people who really want to spend however much time thinking about what the end of their life was going to be. And so a sort of basic insight we had into this, one of those aha moments about how we might do this differently, was the thought that we should think about advanced care planning like other health behaviors that people ought to do, but they don't do. Things like cancer screening, exercise, smoking cessation, you can finish the list. Well, I'm fortunate enough in New Haven to be just up 95 from, or down 95 from the group at the University of Rhode Island who came up with one of the most powerful models of behavior change, which is the trans-theoretical model. And for those of you either in medical school or had been in medical school, you've all heard about this because that's the when you learned about those pre-contemplating smokers that you're not supposed to give intervention materials to because it won't work. That's the trans-theoretical model. It's you'll see it's very common sense based because it and it, because of that, I think it's been shown to work in a number of instances that if you think about the tenets and make your intervention on those tenets, you can change behavior. So the central organizing focus of the trans-theoretical model is this temporal component, stages of behavior change. It's the notion that people go through stages of change. Pre-contemplation is you're just not planning on changing your behavior. It's not something that you're going to do. Contemplation, you're thinking about changing behavior in the sometime down the road in the future. Preparation, you actually have a plan to change your behavior soon. And then action and maintenance, either you've achieved the behavior change, or for maintenance, it's happened already and you're maintaining that behavior change. And so the organizing principle for interventions is that your intervention needs to be matched to the individual stage of behavior change. If somebody's telling you, I can't bear to think about getting sick, it's just too distressing for me, putting a living will in front of them is not going to work. So there are some ways that have been shown that you can help people move through those stages of change. Another organizing principle is this notion of decisional balance, where people have in their head the pros of changing their behavior and the cons of changing their behavior. So if you're going to change, you need to increase the people's sense of the pros and decrease the people's sense of the cons. Again, this is not rocket science, but it's very powerful because it actually explains how people do these things. And then the last notion is that individuals use some cognitive processes in the early stages and then more behavioral processes in the later stages of behavior change. So some of these processes are consciousness raising. You have to make yourself aware that this is an issue that one ought to be engaged in. Self-reevaluation is how am I going to do this? Some of the behavioral ones are get some help from people that you know and love. Stimulus control and self-liberation, I'll show you some examples of how that works with advanced care planning in just a moment. So we have to deal with the implications of a public health model for advanced care planning, because these models of behavior change are thinking about behavior change on the big level. The idea is that if you can give this tailored feedback, you can do it in an efficient way to large numbers of people to get whole populations to move. Well, advanced care planning has traditionally been thought of as something that occurs between doctor and patient, very personal, very clinical. And in fact, the few successful interventions to promote advanced care planning rely on trained facilitators who conduct lengthy, moderated interviews between patients and surrogates to try to get them over these barriers, get them engaged. But the issue is, I think it's unrealistic to think that that's going to be widely adopted. These are hugely expensive, time-intensive interventions. So the idea is, can we use the TTM to build these expert systems that deliver tailored feedback to people without the need for trained interventionists? And that's the assertion I'm putting forward is yes, I think it can. It's been shown now that these interventions have changed attitudes and intentions toward organ donation, toward blood donation, things that also might be seen on one level as needing to be clinical, personal, I think that that may not be the case. And we can up the scale at which we think about changing behavior. Why do I say that? Well, because we've done some work to see, does this health behavior model fit advanced care planning? That was the first question we wanted to ask. And so to answer that question, we did a qualitative study of 63 older persons and 30 caregivers who had experience as surrogate decision makers. We did focus groups among the older persons separately from the caregivers, but also stratified by whether or not the individual had participated in a process of advanced care planning. And so this is our older persons who were in the study. They had a mean age of 76. 68% were women. They had more than a high school education. 57% were white and 37% were black. You can see the rest of the categories. You can see, though, importantly, that a lot of folks had a lot of chronic conditions. So they represented people who had a fair amount of chronic disease. And then our caregivers were younger, predominantly female, because a lot of these caregivers were the wives of patients. They weren't necessarily matched up with the patients. We recruited these two groups separately. And they were accurate, I think. They were caregivers who were providing care with daily contact with the patient. So what did they have to say to us? Well, the first thing was, very gratifyingly, this notion of readiness came up right away in the interview. So one of the very first people said, you have to be ready to participate. I don't know what makes you ready. Well, okay, that'll be our job to untangle later, but at least a recognition that, yeah, you can't do it until you're ready. So then these are some quotes that actually, and these are all direct quotes from the people we studied, because I'd like you to hear their voices, that represent the different stages of behavior change. I'm going to tell you, I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to discuss it. I don't want to hear that morbid talk. Clearly, an intervention aimed at that person is going to be very different from the person who says, after listening to you today, I think I will participate in advanced care planning. I got some good points just listening. Very different readiness for change. For this person, some education was all that this person needed. Then I've been thinking about it lately that I need to get a healthcare proxy. I want it in black and white. I'm going to take care of it. Asked me after the interview where to get the forms, and that person was off and running and presumably changing his behavior. What we found also was that there was a wide range of benefits and barriers, which is really just another way of thinking about the pros and cons of behavior change. So some of the benefits that people told us about were the idea that it ensured that if you did have strong wishes, this was the way that you could help ensure that they were going to be met. This notion that once you did it, you could put it behind you. It was a good feeling to have it done, because as painful as it was, of course, we're going to be reminding people that they do need to revisit it. At least for a period of time, you can put it out of your mind. You've done it. This notion of decreasing burden, which has been found in lots of studies, and also this idea of maybe keeping the peace in the family. And then the cons. It's just too difficult to think about dying. It's impossible to plan for the future. That the future's in God's hands. So there were a few people actually who get offended when you talk about this because you're messing with a bigger plan. Concern again, the treatment will be withdrawn too, so better not put it in writing because they'll use that as an excuse to pull the plug. Particular difficulty thinking about situations where uncertainty is involved. And then the idea that I'm ready, but my loved one isn't. I can't get him or her to talk about this. We also saw that there were a wide range of processes that people used. So they thought about the recommendations. You know, oh yeah, my doctor did talk about that, or my daughter said I ought to be doing this. And then the flip side of, well, my daughter can help me is, you know what, maybe my daughter could. This notion of reflecting on the experiences of others, oh yeah, you know, my aunt had a terrible experience and I don't want things to go like that for me. Recognizing susceptibility is a huge thing, right? If you think, which, and we have some data on this, that even when you interview people who have advanced illness, a good proportion of them think that they're just going to die in their sleep. So none of these decisions are going to need to be made. If you don't recognize that you might face one of these decisions, you're not going to engage in the process. and then reflecting on the fact that there could be positive consequences to get them over the negative consequences. And here's just a few more of the behavioral ones. Seeking out information, actually getting to see whether loved ones are ready, or even strategizing about how one might get over their defensiveness, which is individualizing communication. Okay, that's the end. So having done that, now we wanted to see, okay, in general, it looks like these concepts work. But if we're going to do this kind of expert system, then we actually need to have measures for each of these constructs. Because the idea is you need to know quantitatively where people fit. And so for this objective of this study, we wanted to see if we could come up with measures, the stages of change, decisional balance. Now, if we go back for just a moment to some of these cons, generally, cons are things that are factually true, like it's difficult to think about dying. That is something that is factually true. How much that's going to impede your ability to engage in ACP is personal. However, we found that there were some statements which were either couldn't be factually proven, such as the future's in God's hands, so religious notions, and also medical misperceptions. Those things, you're not going to change people's minds about very easily. So when it came time to doing our scales, we thought it was really important to actually represent those separately because they have different implications for intervention because of the fact that their nature is different. And then the processes of change. So what we did here was to recruit older persons in the community from physicians' offices and senior centers. We had a wide range of items that we started with, and we used their responses to come up with the scales. Now, I'm not a psychometrician. I don't like this stuff, but you need to do it in order to get these accepted and published. So that's why I teamed up with my friends at URI, because they love this. So I had fun writing all the different items that I thought represented the constructs, and then they did the math to figure out which of these items hung together the best so that you choose the smallest number of items that hang together and represent your concept. And then what you do is you see, once you create those scales, do you represent the hypotheses that the model would suggest should be the case? So here's this population. Looks an awful lot like our qualitative population from recruiting from the same site. I think importantly, again, mean age of 75, 3/4 were women, 26% of non-white ethnicity. We had 43% living alone, 20% had one or more IADL disabilities, and a smaller proportion either rated their health or their quality of life as poor. There were poor. And so what I first want to show you is what we found for stages of change. And so we, according to the model that I presented in the first half of the talk, we knew that we were going to need to represent advanced care planning as a group of behaviors, a group of interrelated behaviors. And what we tried to do was to capture the smallest amount that we thought got at the key concepts. So we kept the traditional stuff because we knew that that's what people were currently familiar with. So completing a living will, completing a healthcare proxy. Then we added talking with loved ones about life-sustaining treatment represented by an item such as, we start with, are you aware that there are treatments that can be used to extend, because you got to start back there, because if the person says no, they're in pre-contemplation. So make sure they understand what life-sustaining treatment is and then ask them, have you talked with your loved ones about that? Also talking with their clinicians about life-sustaining treatment. We also asked them about talking with their loved ones about quality versus quantity of life, because of all that goal stuff, really what, again, we're trying to distill down is there a point for you where quality of life becomes more important than quantity of life? That's really the very first piece of that goal discussion. So again, similarly, made sure people were aware of what that was. If they weren't, they went into the earliest stage of behavior change, and then talking with clinicians about the same thing. And so what we have here, pre-contemplation, again, remembering not considering behavior change, contemplation, I'm thinking about it, preparation. I'm actually getting ready to do it, and then I've either done it or I've done it recently or in the more distant past. And so what you can see here is that half of our population had completed a living will, about a third a healthcare proxy, with a pretty large percentage in the earliest proportion, the earliest stage of behavior change. Interestingly, more people said that they had, in fact, talked with their loved ones about life-sustaining treatment and about quality versus quantity of life, but very, very few people had actually talked with their clinician, and this was any clinician, about these things, with very large numbers not even being aware that this was something they ought to be doing. What was interesting, I thought, here is how people dichotomized. You had a group of people who either had done it, and then this other group who, for a whole lot of reasons, just weren't thinking about doing it. Now, the question we wanted to ask next was, are these the same people? If you've done one of these behaviors, does that mean that you've done the other behaviors? And the answer to that is no. So what we did here was to look at the two behaviors where you thought if any two should be concordant, it should be this one. Because if you filled out a living will, it might be a good thing that you've talked with your loved ones, that you've signed a document talking about how you feel about life-sustaining treatment. Well, the blue represent those people who are concordant, who were in the same stage for having completed a living will and for having communicated with their family. And what you can see is that that represents about 60%, which means that 40% of our population were in different stages of change for the two behaviors. So suggesting that you can't assume that if somebody's done one of these behaviors, they've done the others. Let me show you what we came up with for our pros of behavior change. And the numbers basically just say that our scale works. It hangs together. All these items load onto this concept. Doing advanced care planning would simplify how decisions would be made. It would be easier on my loved ones. It would help my loved ones to ensure I get the care I want. I would feel better knowing I've done what I can do to plan. Would give me peace of mind. Would give me control. For our cons, I don't like thinking about being ill. I can't face the fact I'm going to die. I don't want to talk with loved ones. Too many options to consider. It goes against my lifestyle of taking one day at a time. And my wishes could change. And then these values and beliefs, getting at the medical misperceptions and the religious items. You fill out a document such as a living will, the doctors are more likely to pull the plug too soon. Once you reach a certain age, sort of the doctors aren't going to use machines. It's sort of the opposite. We had quite a few people endorse this kind of, I don't have to worry about this, I'm 80. Who's going to do this stuff to me? My doctor knows what I want. I'll always be able to make my own treatment decisions. And then here, it would interfere with the plans that the Lord had for me. If I'm made to suffer, there must be a good reason for it. So why should I do anything to try to prevent that? And this makes sense only for people who are much older or sicker than I am, endorsed by people in their 80s and 90s. We do the processes of behavior change. So this is this, I look for information about advanced care planning. I think about the information. I remember information. This is this self-reevaluation, how you have to think about yourself to make you want to do this. It makes me feel like a person who cares about my loved ones. I can reduce suffering if I do this, and it makes me feel good about taking responsibility. Helping relationships, I can count on my loved ones, they will support me, and there's someone I can talk to. This stimulus control is the idea, this works better for smoking, but we actually were able to adapt it for advanced care planning. So obviously smoking is, you know, I don't sit in a smoky bar next to people who have cigarettes in their hands, but this is the idea of, here what we're doing is, in order to keep this active, I give documents to people. I review my documents. I know where they are. And then finally, the self-liberation. This is, I'm going to do this. I feel committed. Now's the right time. I can do this. So those are the processes of care. Now moving on to the hypotheses. So what I'm showing you here is we did this for all of the different behaviors. And the graphs look pretty similar. So I'm going to show you this one, which is the stage of living will by decisional balance. The dark line are the pros, and the dotted line are the cons. And at least cross-sectionally, this works. These are all T-scores, so this is a pretty good effect size. We have the pros going up and the cons going down as people, at least cross-sectionally, are in these different stages of behavior. Clearly, what we'd like to do is longitudinally, you want to see if where people are at today predict what they're going to be doing 6 months from now. Also, for our values and beliefs, those similarly go down as people are in the later stages of behavior change. And then this is a little messy, but these show all of those different processes of care. This one is the behavioral one, which is supposed to go up later than the attitudinal ones. So what this is basically showing is that this is working. This is not dissimilar from other behaviors where your peak use of these behavior stages is as you're getting ready to engage in the behavior. And then, again, the behavioral one goes up as you're actually engaged. The other ones begin to go down. But again, showing that the tenets of the model work. So what does that mean for intervention? Well, the idea is we want to try now to manipulate those manipulatable things, the pros, the cons, the values and beliefs, the processes. So you use a tailored stage-based intervention that's based on this thing called an expert system, which assesses individuals on each measure and then uses the data that we already collected to figure out which variables of all of those are most strongly associated with getting people to change their behavior. And then you give feedback on those particular variables. On your baseline, you give feedback to people on how they compare based on their fellow persons. It's amazing what a little peer pressure will do here. And then in follow-up, you give them feedback on how they've changed from where they were before. And what that allows you to do is to highlight even small changes and be able to give people positive feedback about what they've already done and where they still need to go. What accompanies this is a stage-based brochure, which is more general information that's appropriate for everybody at a given stage of behavior change. Now, this is going to be a little complicated, right? Because I showed you that we have 6 different behaviors, and you can't assume that people are in the same stage for all of them. So the way that this works is you assess for each behavior separately, give the feedback for each behavior separately. I cannot do this without my friends in Rhode Island because they actually have proprietary software to create this behavior change algorithm and feedback. But the hope is that we're actually going to be able to get money to do that because here's the power. This is something that you can do putting a kiosk. I mean, especially I work at the VA where there are computers all over the place. And right now, all they're used for is to show these basically big fancy advertisements on these big screens as you walk in. How much better to get people to sit down, the health assistant could take your blood pressure, take your temperature, and then say, I want you to sit down at this computer and fill this out. You get your feedback right away, you take it with you, and you can do this over time. This is our vision for how we would like to promote advanced care planning on a wider scale. There's a lot of skeptics out there who say you can't change behavior by giving people written stuff. But the idea is that if the stuff is tailored, it's more powerful than generic materials. And I hope that maybe someday you'll invite me back because I'll be able to tell you that this has worked. But in the meantime, I've left time. So if people have questions or comments for me, I'd really love to hear your thoughts. So thank you very much. That's a really good question. Some studies have shown that there's actually some conflicting results about this because Some studies have shown that greater education is associated with a greater likelihood of actually participating in advanced care planning, but it's also the case that more educated people are, it's again that dichotomy, can be in the earliest stages of behavior change because they have the greatest cons about, I can't think about this, you know. And also, I think part of it true is that false sense of belief that I'm going to be in control. So that it's an interesting, education works in complicated ways. What we were able to show, though, was that even among our folks here who had less education, we did a lot of pilot testing to ensure that they understood what we were asking, so that we have a good sense that we can use these assessment materials with people at all educational levels. But it's not a straightforward answer about how education interacts with how people engage. Thank you. I'm glad you actually gave me the excuse to talk about that for a few minutes. In New Haven, our non-white population is virtually all African-American. We have an older Latino community, but they are Spanish-speaking only. And we made the conscious decision not to just translate our measures into Spanish. I'm going to get back to that point in a minute, why that. We have very few Asian Americans or Pacific Islanders. So that population was largely African American. The items in the religious items in those values and belief scales came almost exclusively from the African American community. So we went back, if I can go back to the slide for a minute, and actually looked at each of these items by race. And again, you can really think about it as, and for this we specifically looked African-American versus white, and the difference in the proportions who endorsed these items was very, very large. So we had very, very few whites saying that they were meant to suffer or that they were worried about the interference with future plans. Very large proportions of African-Americans. Although the differences were not as great for the medical misperception items, there was still a significant difference by race. Across the board, for the other items, race is associated with stage of change for all of these behaviors. So African-Americans were always statistically more likely to be in the earlier stages of change for all of the behaviors, endorsed more cons, and endorsed fewer pros. So everything suggested that they were in earlier stages of behavior change. You're absolutely right. That raises the question of what this means culturally, what this means for different ethnic groups. That's why we decided not simply to translate these items, because there's a thought that from some work done in the Latino community, there's even different ways about thinking about this that we're not going to capture if we don't go back and actually do the groundwork by having people talk about their experiences. So we actually have a grant that's going to be reviewed shortly to do just that. That was so big that when we thought about expanding the work to, for example, Asians, the feedback I got was, oh, no, because that's yet another effort, because based on country of origin, based on language, there's even more consideration. So I'm very humbled by the language, cultural influences on this. And I'll be the first one to admit that this is limited, but at least it's a model that we can then take and slowly work our way through to expand to these different populations. But I'm so glad you asked your question to raise those issues, because they're huge when it comes to advanced care planning. Yeah.
So one is a comment and the other is a question. The first comment is, a lot of times, you know, when palliative care will have a completely blank slate for any advanced directives discussion of any kind. And this strikes me as, you know, primary care, health maintenance, that, you know, it doesn't happen in so many different ways. And then you come to the hospital where it's illness management, not health maintenance. And in palliative care, we end up having to do these things in an emergency setting to establish them. So I'm wondering, my question is, has this been thought of in two different ways? One, rather than a longitudinal sort of an emergency application process. And then the second is, this is very much based on the individual. But we know in in these moments that it's rarely the individual making that decision. It's a network of family members and stakeholders.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering how the model is going to work outside of the hospital to get these disparate parties all on the same page, because the whole, you can't expect nine people to come to the doctor's office.
Right.
And I just wonder how you guys are thinking of that.
So I love this idea. I had never thought about the emergency application before. I'm just not convinced that, you're left with, we need to do something, right? Until I can get my grants and get this out in the primary care world, there's going to be a need for this. I'll have to think about that, but I suppose one could strip down, at least these kinds of assessments can give you quick insight into where the person's coming from, and you can do a sort of focused, still probably better than for somebody who's never thought about this, to have their first question be, do you want to be DNR or not? Some compressed process could hold a lot of power, so yeah, we should definitely chat. And then the second question, in the interest of time, I didn't show you these data. We developed the same measures for surrogates, and they work in the surrogates as well. There are different items that pop out because we tried to make all the items parallel, but then we did separate analyses to see what would be most important to the surrogates, and you get very similar findings. So that ideally, what would happen is that in the outpatient setting, you might not get the whole family, but you can get the person who would be identified as the surrogate decision maker to go through the same assessment and get the same set of materials. Because interestingly, in other work we've done, which is maybe even scarier than some of the work that I've shown you here, when you take the patient and you take their self, the person they say is the surrogate, and you ask them about the stages of change for the patient, not for each one, but for the patient, huge proportions report that different things have happened. We'd like to find out more about what's going on there, because boy, is it bad if the patient says, oh yeah, I've talked to my surrogate about my feelings on life-sustaining treatment. The surrogate says, I haven't heard anything. And we've heard it in both directions. Surrogate saying, oh yeah, I've heard from the patient. The patient's saying, I didn't have that conversation. We excluded people with cognitive impairment, so we don't think that's the explanation. But it suggests that you're absolutely right. This eventually, we wanted to, of course, you have to start somewhere. But the big vision is that you want the process to encompass both parties, and we're trying to develop that as well. So I completely blanch at the thought of trying to change clinician and much of the school that perhaps that really the only effective way to do that is by changing patient behavior and having the patient be the driver. Patients are really good at getting antibiotics for viral infections, right? So that seems to me to be it's not working now, but I think it's a more promising model, although I will say there are people who are working on trying to change physician behavior. I think that that's a whole separate thing that I'm not under. You're absolutely right, and there's data to prove that, right? Because the group who developed that intensive moderator-based intervention did it in the setting of having already shown that this is in Wisconsin, where they have a fairly closed system, that a huge proportion of people, in fact, already had advanced care planning documents in the chart, partly because there were two things going on. One is the integrated system and strong primary care, strong relationships. The other thing was the normalization of the process. It didn't seem like somebody coming from out of the blue all of a sudden, oh, why are they asking me this? I mean, that's the other part of the primary care model. This becomes like, you know, I'm going to bug you about your mammography. I'm also going to bug you about this because it's a standard part of the care that we deliver. So that's an excellent observation.